to turn on the microphone?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. And I will turn it over for our safety advice first. Jim?
Good afternoon, Chairman Dowling, members of the board. We covered the exits earlier this morning, so we do have a safety contact for you in reference the daylight savings time that begins at 2 a.m. on the second Sunday of March, which is this Sunday, March 11th. The time change is a good time to make a habit to take care of semi-annual home safety tasks. The following are some tips that can be used at home every 6 months to help keep you and your loved ones safe. Check and replace the batteries in your smoke and carbon monoxide alarms or detectors. Remember to check the age of your detectors. The U.S. Consumer Product Safety Commission suggests not only to change the batteries in alarm, but also check the age of the alarms and replace older alarms. The Consumer Product Safety Commission suggests that consumers replace smoke alarms every 10 years and replace carbon monoxide alarms every 5 years. Sensors in smoke and carbon monoxide alarms degrade and lose effectiveness over time through environmental contamination and age. Check the contents of your home emergency kit. Replace anything that is outdated or needs to be replenished. If you don't have a kit, put one together that includes such things as water, food, flashlight, batteries, and blankets. Check home and outbuilding storage areas for hazardous materials. Properly discard any which are outdated, no longer used, or in poor condition. Move any which are within reach of kids or pets. Check your medicine chest and throw out any outdated medications. This goes for over-the-counter meds, too. Some can cause serious problems if they are used after their expiration date. Making it a habit of running through these tips twice a year can help to make you and your family safer and more prepared. That concludes the safety conversation.
We have an agenda for the meeting, which is a quarterly meeting where we deal with security, but we have a few other items as well. Are there any comments on the agenda?
Second.
Moved and seconded. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Last month we did talk about a longer-term agenda for the committee, and I've gotten some suggestions from committee members on topics that we should pick up on either with briefings or regular memos, and I will make staff aware of those and get it around to the committee in terms of things that we should be watching. Some are more immediate, some are longer term, but I think they are important safety issues that we need to keep up on. We have minutes from the meeting of February 23rd. I have a motion to approve the minutes. Any amendments to the minutes? Not. All in favor?
Aye.
We've had the presentation of the award, which was on the agenda. Fortunately, we didn't make Administrator Pistol wait to this point, but I would ask the Chief just to comment on what that award signified.
Sure, sir. Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, other members of the committee. The Gold Standard Award that Administrator Pistol provided to us, we were among 17 transit agencies across the country who participated in the baseline assessment for security enhancements, and these are a combination of 17 items that transit agencies have been identified to bolster their security posture. Some of the areas would include having a security emergency plan, conducting annual drills and exercises, access control, having things that address access control, public awareness, conducting, again, background checks, training, employee training, looking and having threat and vulnerability assessments conducted on your police department or transit agencies, and a host of other issues that collectively between the TSA and FTA, who originally came out with protective measures and the baseline, they were adopted by the Transportation Security Administration. It also speaks to collaboration with the federal government, local jurisdictions, and things of that nature. And the WMATA received a 97% score, a very high score in comparison to the others. I won't get into the specifics as to who was the top, but under the leadership of Mr. Sawes, we are the best when it comes to that, so I'll say that. It was a presentation that the administrator felt compelled to give and present directly to the general manager because of all of the outstanding efforts. I think that we benefited tremendously because of where we are located, in the seat of the government and the importance of WMATA to this region, both the federal employees as well as other citizens who use the metro. And it's a continuous effort, again, working with so many people here at WMATA, safety, rail operations. We will continue to put ourselves in a position that, one, we educate our employees and the public, that we enhance our public awareness, and that we constantly look to improve our employee training.
And our score the last time, which was a few years ago, was nowhere near 97.
No, it wasn't. It was probably, I think it was about 85 or something like that.
In an improvement mode, but we have to stay there.
Absolutely.
Thank you. As I said, this month is the quarterly security report, and I'll let the Chief continue with that.
Thank you again, sir. So what we're presenting today is the fourth quarter of calendar year 2011, and we're given a complete overview of the stats for the entire year, calendar year 11. You'll see and notice that Part 1 crimes, of which I will spend a little time talking about what they constitute, was down approximately 16.39% for WMATA. I have some information that speaks to Part 1 crimes in the region without identifying a particular jurisdiction, but I will say that Part 1 crimes in this region, there was one jurisdiction that had 35,641 Part 1 crimes. The closest jurisdiction that came to WMATA was Frederick Police Department, which had something like 2,240. We encompass the entire jurisdictional area, both Maryland, Virginia, and the District of Columbia, so I would like to put that in context. And as we go through the various jurisdictions, we will break that down again to talk about the types of Part 1 crimes. There has been a comparison made about the category of Part 1 crimes. One of those categories is larceny. Larceny means the taking of anything of any value. With WMATA and the Metro Transit Police, it could be a $5 item. We count that as a Part 1 crime, contrary to some jurisdictions who have a $1,000 limit. So in the context of Part 1 crimes, we'll be able to talk about that specifically. We've had a total of 1,922 arrests. Again, the arrests have gone down for the year because we've been placing considerable more emphasis on uniform visibility and presence as we go out and we address the school kids and a variety of other details that take place throughout the system. Again, the enforcement efforts on citations and summonses, they were representative of a 6% increase, whether it's smoking, eating, or drinking, or criminal or civil citations that we, utilizing the jurisdictional agency's citations, we write those citations. When we look at the robbery breakdown, there was a 44% reduction in robbery snatches. And there was a 23% reduction in robbery force and violence, armed robbery a 10% reduction, pickpocket, which is a crime that if it goes unnoticed may very well be a lost property. It was a 3% reduction in robbery fear, and for the lowest time in 4 years, bus operators' assaults were down 27%. So it went from last year, 90 to this year, or last, from calendar year 10 to calendar year 11, it was 90 and 66, respectfully. And we'll get in to talk about what that represents. The probability of being a victim of a crime is very important as well. For Part 1 crimes, it's 5.61 per million riders. Now, when you look at crime statistics that are reported to the Washington Metropolitan Council of Governments, their crime statistics are based on 1,000 residents. So when you look at the high for one of those jurisdictions, it was 57.1 for 1,000 residents, Part 1 crime. So as we look and compare and contrast, we definitely need to put things in perspective. One crime on the metro is one crime too many, but we are safe in comparison to the National Capital Region, and we'll go on to talk about that a little more. Now, the next slide talks about why was crime reduced in 2011. And so there's a combination of a variety of things that we attribute to. One of those things was Metrostat, mitigating enforcement of transit-related offenses statistics, which was developed to combat crime of WMATA patrons, personnel, property, and revenue. Metrostat is based on five principles, which have been identified as best practices by law enforcement agencies in the establishment of a crime control model. It started out in New York City Transit, Bill Bratton at the time, looking at trends and hot spots and focusing the efforts on those particular areas. Many transit agencies have adopted, in particular, we just visited MTA Baltimore. One of the great benefits of Metrostat is the commitment on the part of executive leadership, and I can tell you that Mr. Sauls has been attending our Metrostats over the last year, and I think he's only missed two. And so accountability, bringing people together, focusing, developing the strategy, measuring the strategy, and expecting results is what we look at. So the guidelines are establishing specific objectives, develop timely and accurate intelligence, design effective strategies and tactics, deploy personnel and resources rapidly, and conduct relentless follow-up and assessments. One of the other things that we can attribute to the reduction of the crime is the outstanding efforts of the officers that are out there carrying out those strategies and procedures. Another area is the public awareness. Without having the public involved, we are facing a losing battle. We have roughly 400-plus police officers, but the thousands upon thousands of eyes and ears of riding public employees that are working in our systems, they give us a lot of information, and so reaching out to them is very important. Technology and equipment, we could not do it without that. We look at the parking lots and the assistance that we've gotten from Dave Kubicek and Linda Stoppagen in purchasing the gators, which we deploy out in the parking lots. We had a lot of problems with our parking-related crimes, and now the presence of someone out there walking, riding through with the lights, it has reduced crime tremendously. We also have mobile towers that we can deploy to parking lots, and sometimes they're manned by police officers. Oftentimes, they may not be. Again, additional technology, smart cameras, as we work toward the future, getting smart cameras that will tell us what we need to look at as it relates to crime. And the most important one, and I think, again, under the leadership of our general manager, going back almost a year ago, where we brought 17 law enforcement leaders together, chiefs and deputy chiefs from all of the jurisdictions, asking them what they could do to assist WMATA in fighting our crime. And so there were a lot of different initiatives that came out of that, the continuation of that, what we've done working with Ms. Artis Hampshire-Cowan and Prince George's County and all of the jurisdictions. That partnership is something that we could not do without. Next slide is the comparison of the fourth quarter, and we look at the various modes. And so we're looking at the fourth quarter in comparison to calendar year 2010. And bus crime was reduced by 48%. Again, it's a direct tribute to the collaboration working with Jack Requa and the various bus superintendents as we go out, Deputy Chief Delinsky and his team meeting with the bus operators, meeting with those that represent the managers, and meeting with 689 leadership to find out where we can improve and enhance our security postures on the buses. The parking lot, again, which was one of our problematic areas, was reduced by 44%, and on the rail, there was a 17% increase. And a lot of that, as I'll talk about a little later, is a direct result of our crime suppression team, where every time there was a robbery, there was an arrest, because most of the people that were getting robbed were our police officers. And so over the three-year period, that's a 61% reduction in the rate of Part 1 crimes in metro parking facilities. Again, bus crime for the fourth quarter was reduced 48% over the same period in 2010. Next slide. Part 1 crimes against person. And again, we talked about how we categorize Part 1 crimes, and I gave you an example of some of the jurisdictional reports of Part 1 crimes. And there was a comparison made of us versus some of the other transit agencies across the country. Many of those transit agencies do not report the petty larcenies, which constitute a Part 1 crime for us. Many of those transit agencies do not report crime with buses. Some of the city police departments handle the buses. Some of those transit agencies don't have parking lots, so they don't report that. Many of those transit agencies have sometimes upwards of 8 to 10 times the number of police officers that we have here in the WMATA system. So I think comparatively speaking, the crime that we have in our system as what we consider when we compare it to what's happening above crime is very low. But we have a concerted effort, and the general manager holds me accountable to reducing it even more. And so that's what we are tasked with doing. The crime suppression team I talked about began operations in late October, and during the fourth quarter made 44 robbery snatch arrests. Without those arrests, snatch would have been reduced from the 2010 fourth quarter statistics by 30%. The CST team also made 13 arrests of pickpockets during that same period of time. And again, if you're ever pickpocket, more often than not, you will not know that you have been, and you would conclude that you've lost something. And so the outstanding efforts of the police department has resulted in the reduction and the apprehensions of a lot of people. When we look at Part 1 crimes against property, again, crime has gone down considerably. Theft of autos were down 17%. Motor vehicle, including the attempts, were down 69%. Bicycle thefts were up for the fourth quarter compared to last from 40 to 77. And in the third month, our crimes suppression team was also given some attention to that crime and added 13 arrests for bike thefts in the fourth quarter. We have additionally purchased 2 more bait bikes, which have been very effective. And at some point in time, we will evaluate the crimes suppression team and deploy them a little differently. So now as we look at the top 10 Metro Rail stations system-wide, we look at Deanwood. Deanwood leads the list with 67, followed by Anacostia, LaFont Plaza, Suitland, College Park, Lago Town Center, Southern Avenue, Minnesota, Gallery Place, and Greenbelt. And it's a sort of balanced. The top 10 system-wide stations had the same amount of crimes against person as crimes against property. As a matter of information, for the purposes of these slides, person crimes are robbery and aggravated assaults. Property crimes, again, are thefts and motor vehicles. Again, I highlighted what is found in the Council of Government's crime report, and if you were to look at that, you would get the exact numbers that I'm talking about. It also has WMATA and their reported crimes. Next slide. In the District of Columbia, the range of 75% to 95% of the crimes were crimes against person. So that is the jurisdictions that mostly involved robberies, robbery snatch, any types of crimes against the person. And you'll see that off to the right is whether or not arrest was made in connection with that particular crime. As a matter of fact, in the District of Columbia, 80% of the top 10 stations have a majority of person-related crimes. When we look at Maryland, we get a somewhat different picture. We have 60 Part 1 crimes and 4 arrests for that, but the range of 65% to 97% are crimes against property. So these are crimes that involve breaking into your vehicle, stealing something that's exposed rather than being confronted by someone that wanted to rob you or things of that nature. The exception to the Maryland statistics is Capitol Heights, which 42% of those crimes are crimes against person. Now, as we go further and look at the Commonwealth of Virginia, if we look at Franconia, Springfield, Vienna, 100% of those crimes were crimes against property. They were crimes involving the stealing of property that was left in the vehicle or things of that nature that did not involve any crimes against the person. And we go down to West Falls Church. 94% of that crime, again, was crime against property. Dunlawn, 100% of that was crime against property. East Falls Church, 92%. And it goes on down. Roslyn had 44% of the crime was crime against property. And So that gives you an indication of the types of crimes. And so when one concludes that Metro is dangerous, I think it's a mislabeling of what it is that we're experiencing relative to crime. And when you compare and contrast the crimes that are in and around the Metro system, you will see that it's not as it's described relative to dangerous. Although, again, the general manager and everybody here understands that one crime is one crime too many. Next slide. Some of the things that we're working on now as we prepare for the Cherry Blossom event, and this is the 100th anniversary of that, we restricted leave. We've worked with the entities within WMATA to come up with plans as to how we would properly equip that. We've worked with our jurisdictional partners, Metropolitan Police, U.S. Park Police, in planning that. We expect it to be a very lively and joyous occasion for a lot of people who are visiting the area, and we will address it as that by being good stewards of customer service and delivering the good message. One of the other items that the administrator had rolled out, working in conjunction with the Peer Advisory Group, which is the top 20 transit agencies across the country, it is bus safe, which is comparable to rail safe. Those of you who are familiar with Amtrak recently rolled it out covering the Northeast Corridor, and now it's extended across the whole country. But it's getting law enforcement along those routes to increase visibility, to work better together, to give out literature. And so we're testing this out, again, working with our jurisdictional partners. April 13th will be a day that we roll out bus safes. And so we expect our police officers to confront and talk to the bus operators, hand out literature at various bus stops and locations, and get on the bus. And collectively, we will send the message that we want to make sure that our employees and our customers are safe and secure. This pilot effort involves Portland, Oregon, Chicago, Los Angeles, Minneapolis, Houston, New York, and other cities will be joining in the near future. One of the things that we've also, next slide, never mind, that we've been doing over the extended period of time following on the leads of the general manager is going out with the police department, meeting and greeting our customers throughout the jurisdictions, finding out exactly what it is that they're finding problematic, whether they be security concerns or any other concerns. And we collect that information, and a lot of that information has been very informative to us. We are given information about certain crimes that are taking place, certain locations that there's a propensity to have young people assembling, and basically the message is pretty much the same. If you can control or address the youth disruption on the system based upon their inconsiderate behavior, things of that nature, and they're always asking for additional police officers and to cover the parking garages, and some of those things are things that we have subsequently provided. And that concludes my presentations. However, I think there was one report that I wanted to share, and this was an example of good partnership with law enforcement agencies and how we work together. It was on March 6th that we were dispatched to Montgomery County General Hospital for a subject that was a victim of stabbing aboard a Metro bus. Units arrived at the hospital, conducted preliminary information, and they found that these subjects were in and around the Prince George's Plaza Mall food court. They were confronted by two suspects that were yelling and using profane language and sort of roughed them up a little bit. They left, but they were provided a description to Hinesville City Police. What happened is that these same four people made contact at Prince George's County Station later on, where two of the subjects stabbed the suspects and beat him up pretty bad. We were able to interview the suspect, get specific information as to what this person was wearing and weapons that they had displayed. This morning, about 2:30, we executed a search and arrest warrant at a location in Northeast Washington, D.C., arrested two subjects, both with evidence that tied them to the assault, and we're going to be prosecuting them to the fullest. But it's an example of working with law enforcement in a timely manner, again, taking advantage of the cameras that we have in our system to identify and prosecute people. So that's the end of my presentation. Open for any questions.
Thank you.
over the last couple of months, we have been reviewing certain incidents that occurred, and one of the questions that was raised is, how do we communicate with our customers during incidents? And Barbara is going to bring us up to date on that set of practices and policies.
Good afternoon. So I am here to update the board on the actions we've taken over the last couple of months to improve communications with customers during emergencies and major service disruptions. And I will say that we've made quite a lot of progress, I think, in the last couple months. But, you know, this is an area that, in my estimation, you can never do enough of, and there's always something else that we can do better, as far as I'm concerned. But we recognize that this is a big area, so we've prioritized our efforts. At first, wanting to make sure that what we are telling customers in terms of the message and what is happening when these incidents occur is that we have, our information is consistent as well as accurate, that we're getting them the information that they need. We also want to be sure that we're speaking in customer, as I say, customer speak, that we translate our operations jargon in our railroad, our bus talk, into information and language that's usable for our customers. That we take advantage of all the different channels that we have to get information because customers receive information in different ways, not always in the same way or through the same means, for instance, so we're leveraging all our channels. And that, as we've learned over time and from personal experience, that we try to reach our customers and the public before they arrive at our system, and that means we're working with a lot of regional partners, but we're putting a little extra emphasis on reaching people before they come to us. So you may recall, if I could just review for a minute, some of the research findings that we've discussed here, in fact, over the last couple of months. And we learned through some of our survey work that customers get their information and say they most want information from us when they're in the system. So in other words, when it's top of mind and when they are with us. So that's one of the challenges that we have. They also need actionable information, not just that an incident has occurred, for instance, or that there is a disruption, but what do I do about it? Sort of more of on a personal level. And that we also heard that if they do get information prior to an event, that they will actually take a different path or that they will make arrangements to take action that's different. And that we've also heard that when incidents occur, to have officials on the scene, which may not always be the police chief and his staff and team, but others who are in an official capacity helping customers, that it's helpful. And also, what we like to say is good old school or old fashioned tools may need to be brought to play too, such as bullhorns and so on, so that we can reach people immediately with information when they're in the environment or in the system. Next slide. So as a starter, if we talk first with the first priority about accuracy and consistent messaging, in the last couple of months, working in partnership with Dave Kubicek, we have instituted an incident communications protocol. And when major incidents occur, Dave or his designee will call a conference call together. The participants of the call include senior officials of rail, bus, police, members of my team, myself, frequently the general manager. And two things really go on in that call. One is, from an operations standpoint, we're making plans and reacting to the incident that has occurred. But also, at another level, we're also taking information in, learning the details, and quickly turning it around into communications messages for customers. Then what happens is, given if it's a major incident, we actually will call into place the protocol. And that means that the communicators, members of my team, will craft the messages. So while that does a couple of things, it allows us to quickly reach customers. It allows the operations team to work on the service part and to remedy what's happening in the system. The messages that we then craft go to our website, which is our number one used tool that we have in terms of communications. It also, we will give information to the rail department, the rail customer service department. They then will use the messages through Metro Alerts, through the public address systems, through the passenger information display systems, and also they will send the information to the dispatch, will then get the information to the train operators. We, of course, then send the messages through the media, and then our own employees, letting them know about it. The police department, the police chief then works with fellow police chiefs and in the other jurisdictions, and then also third-party stakeholders and networks. So the Coalition of Governments for COG has a whole network, the Regional Incident Communication Coordinator System. We also have, and there are all these acronyms for these two, I guess. We have MATOC, which is the DOT level network. And then we also have the Virtual Joint Information Center as well. So I just want to be able to convey to you that we're working at a regional level as well as going all the way to the platform level. So it was very exciting for us last week to be able to launch Metro Alerts, and that is another advanced version of our rail alert system. And so now for the first time, as an extension of the next bus program, which is the predictor on the best bus service, is that bus passengers have an opportunity, as rail customers have had the opportunity, to sign up for route-specific alerts and route-specific advisories. So it's a major improvement on the bus side. And then the other piece of this that's important is that we have two communications staff members now in the Bus Operations Control Center. So they are helping craft messages and helping the control center communicate. On the rail side, there's also additional improvements because now we're able to send more lengthy advisories to our rail customers. And then they are also able now to sign up for four stations. So previously, it was maybe line-specific, but now we're really taking it down to a more personalized and more segmented kind of an approach, because in this environment, everyone wants to know the information for themselves. Well, now we're able to do that, because now we're able to get station-specific, up to four stations and the line, as well as when you ride, what, you know, do you normally ride Monday through Friday, or the time frame that you also ride. And then on the bus side, you can choose up to four different routes. And in that route structure, there are multiple bus options in there. So we're very excited about this. We've gone from 9,000 accounts, 9,000 subscribers, and in just 1 week's time, 2,600 new subscribers have signed up. So this is a really great advancement, so you can tell we're really excited, or at least I am. So anyway, we have a campaign that we'll be rolling out in the next week. And this is part of our tagline, no more, no first, and there are other ones, so you'll see more on the system, and also you'll be hearing announcements, too, about it to get more people to sign up. If you go on, but there have also been other digital enhancements, as I would call them. First, you'll see that we are calling out the blue-orange service disruptions with the colors. Previously, we only had the service status to be able to show that there was a disruption or our news release, but now this is really bold. So if anybody, the first thing they'll see during a major disruption is this, that they'll know. And I would say you should know that on any given average day, we receive over 100,000 visitors to our website, 3 million in a year, so it is a major tool for us. Also, you've heard me talk before about our social media program, and I guess it's more of a demonstration of how far we've come. In the over the last year, we've tripled our following on Twitter, and so we're at about 25,000 followers. Other improvements, actually, I should give give a credit and a thank you to Board Member Hines when I did the briefing on the DuPont Circle Station entrance closure. So we went back, and now we are able to, if you call up a certain station, we're able to do an advisory automatically in your trip planner program. So thank you for that idea. That was good. We appreciate that. And then the middle one is an example of a rail advisory that you would get now through the Metro Alert system. You would get an advisory. It would just have a few words and a link. And when you would click on it, either through, you know, your cell phone or at your terminal, your computer terminal in your office, it will take you here. And the idea is to have a place where we're able to give people more information, more in-depth information, and particularly advance notice on things. And then, as you can see here, this is one of my favorites, is Dan on Skype. And Dan, we have this tool now. Lots of families use it to communicate around the world and the country. And there are times when we are not able to send out a spokesperson in the middle of a blizzard, for instance. And this was, I think, during, was it the Hurricane Irene? So, or a major weather event. So we use this tool as well to communicate. So in system, we're still working with the passenger information displays, but we're working with rail on actually taking off, getting down and taking off messages that we can communicate in other ways so that the predictor for the train is up more than a lot of the other narratives. So that helps customers because they're looking at that as a tool for when's the next train coming and when. The other, as I mentioned before, we're trying to supplement that tool with other methods. We recently went through and made sure that we have bullhorns at every station, kiosks. And in the next month, we're also going to replace some of the aluminum signs. And sometimes, I've seen it in other places, it's absolutely, you would not think of it, but there are times when you actually need a whiteboard when things are going on. And so we have some new signage that's coming for the station managers that will allow them to actually put a message right up in a hurry. So that's coming out soon, and we've been working on that. In the capital program, I think you've heard Rob Troop talk about and Dave talk about before, but we're replacing PA systems in the stations, so that's helpful and useful. And also there's a new protocol on the rail side that when major disruptions occur, there are rail supervisors that are called in and dispatched to various locations depending upon where this situation or incident has occurred, because customers really need to see people out there, as well as the police officers who are already out there. And then we in our own area on the media side, if there are major disruptions, and generally we have, this is all a big judgment call, if it's 30 minutes or gets longer, we try to get somebody out to the scene. There are instances, for instance, when it is better if we would put someone on Skype or they sit in headquarters and get the information out. But as a general rule, that's kind of what we're looking at. As I mentioned earlier,
quick question on the on-scene supervision that's there from rail. Are they identifiable? They have their vests on, people can look for.
They have safety vests, right, Dave?
Yeah. Yes, they do have safety vests, as well as we're working down to the level of expecting certain individuals to be at certain stations as we work on deploying. So it's not only at the actual location that we should footnote, but it's also the time of day and where we should also put them throughout the rest of the system as well, just in case we have some type of backup.
As I mentioned, advance notification is very important, and we really have a pattern and a method going with Metro Forward and the work that we have on the weekends. But also when we do major work, such as the DuPont Circle, there are some other tools that we've put in place. This shows the variable message sign that we've used. And when we did some research with customers on, did you know that the DuPont Circle entrance was going to close, this was one of the things that they cited, that they saw, and that was how they were alerted that it was going to close. So sometimes it takes that much of a jar in people's, you know, as people have their earphones on and so on. Sometimes that's what you have to do. And then also at DuPont, we have the police presence there as well as extra staff on scene. So they serve also a key communications role for customers too. So these are some of the work that we're doing. I will also tell you just in general that we're also leading I'm leading a task force of staff from rail, bus, communications, public relations, and we're continuing to work on a whole host of other communications tools and advancements that we hope to be able to share with you going forward. But these are some of the things that we're doing to get to people during incidents and major events. And I would just like to close with an appeal that anyone who sees this message, that please sign up for Metro Alerts. It is the most direct way and fastest way to get information about not only incidents, but also I would suggest work that's coming up that we have. We're going to be using this, as we do, to alert people about disruptions that we know about, as well as those that we don't know about. So thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for Barbara? Yes.
Barbara, when you talked about the stakeholder reach out in communicating the information out, does this get to the PIOs in the jurisdictions that we deal with?
Yes, they're all a part of the joint, the V, which one?
The cloud system, yeah. Thanks.
And a comment earlier about sign-ups for the alert, because 2,600 have signed up for bus alert.
And it may be a combo of bus and rail, but 2,600 since we launched a week ago.
How many do we have on rail alert?
80,000.
Other questions? Thank you, Barbara. Your customers will love us. Love you. Hate us. They'll love you.
Hate us.
That's right. All right, another follow-up item from the discussion of a month or two ago about the brake issues. There were two, if you remember. There was the friction ring on the older cars and the brake hub on some of the newer fleet. I gather we have an update on what we've learned with respect to the brake hub.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Downing. This presentation will provide the committee with a summary of the conclusions from our investigation into the brake issue we experienced in December on the 5000 series rail car. The above is basically just kind of some guidelines in which we followed as we conducted this review. Next slide, please. Last December, a train operating on the orange-blue line was brought to a safe stop by an operator when a train lost a friction ring from car 512. It basically was the hub assembly that failed. After that, we conducted put together an investigation committee. It was comprised of our rail car vehicle engineering, a quality department, safety department, car maintenance staff, as well as we brought in outside consultant LTK. The Tri-State Oversight Committee also participated. And we also did notify the National Transportation Safety Board about the findings. They did not directly participate, but they were involved. Also along those lines, we did send out materials that failed, but also newer products that we had from different batches and stuff to the lab. So it wasn't just, we weren't also just concerned about why we had a failure, but since this fleet is so old or older, and then you have all these different revisions and stuff, you really have to go through all these different revisions. And so we did that independently as well. Even though we do get reports and stuff from original equipment manufacturers and sales and everything else, we want to make sure that we covered our spectrum independently. So basically that completed, you know, kind of the protocol of what we set in motion along with reviewing all historical information. Next slide is the committee determined that the failure occurred was the outside diameter of the hub, you know, the conjunction between the actual axle and the hub body. Basically, if you've seen like a like a spool, like for thread or something. Basically, it's a device that bolts up to the end of the axle, and this device sticks out, and it supports all of the weight. The hub design was consistent with the original specifications from the car builder to the supplier. And this is very important to note. Whenever these designs and stuff were put together, basically there's a requirement outlined by WMATA. It's given to the car builder. The car builder is supposed to go out and design and to verify that. From there, the car builder really provides the spec which the sub is supposed to build to. Okay? So, and we'll talk about this a little bit more in the presentation as we go forward, but I did want to footnote at this time. Based on the design that was done back in the 90s, that was originally done, the lab report confirmed that the root cause was fatigue stress, simply, which means that the metal broke as a result of vibration and forces causing stress on the metal car as it operates over the track. So it wasn't a process issue or anything else, but it was just due to the application, and it got down to fatigue. Okay, some of the conclusions. As we go forward on this, the replacement hubs that we're looking at are definitely more robust than the original design, and, you know, they're expected to last the life of the product. And that was one of the confusing things about this review, is that this product that we have is pretty much supposed to last 30, 35 years. And so for it to fail prematurely was of great concern. The lab also, what we sent out of the new materials, even though what the consultants told us, even what the vendor told us, even what the car builder told us, we went out and actually verified through an independent lab to say, what we were getting in this new design, its material makeup and its composition and its strength and stuff, is meeting that requirement. And it did also help confirm that. Some of the other things that it did note is that these products now are heat treated. Beforehand, they were just a regular turn product. And again, we're in a whole different type of alloy that's being used, whole different metal composition, basically. The campaign of the retrofit, you know, for the 5K cars, is nearly complete. The only ones that we have up, say, for instance, the 2% we left out is, say, for instance, any of the cars that were held out for accidents or for, or say, for instance, like for the June 20, 2009 incident, those are cars that are under impound. So those are the type of vehicles that we just simply can't touch and address, but everything else that we are working on. When we looked at this, probably about 50% of the hubs, when we started looking at this, were impacted, and we've replaced those already at this point in time. Okay, further corrective actions. The inspections of the rail cars using the old hubs will continue until, you know, all the hubs and stuff have been replaced. So basically with the replacement, we're down to a vehicle level of what we need to monitor. We've also looked at this because the hubs that will be installed on the 6K cars will begin in this summer, even though they've given us out to like calendar year 2014 to do this type of work and stuff. We're not going to wait for that. We're going to go ahead and start taking care of it this summer. Okay? A look back. You know, as part of the investigation, we took a long history into the original hubs, and we also know that we could not find another transit authority that used this exact product. It was pretty much unique to WMATA with its design and such. We did look back, and there were two failures in 2006. And again, that gets into, you know, the product was developed in the 90s. It was deployed. They started running, started operating. And basically, that's whenever we had direct involvement with the car builder and Knorr, which is the original equipment manufacturer of those. As we started working on this, basically it took several years, or a couple of years, for Knorr to conclude its analysis. And one of the things that came out of this is that what they had originally monitored and developed a standard for these, they found out that the environment in which these products and stuff were being placed in were much more aggressive. They were much the duty cycle was different, and the shock and vibration was much greater. This also goes back to a fundamental change where WMATA has to and must continue to have more direct involvement. We have to have the tooling and the equipment to help make sure that we're establishing the right protocol. We cannot just rely on, you know, an industry basis is nice to use, but we really have to be specific for our operating environment. And also, we cannot rely on second and third-hand parties. While they're great for us to use as a reference and a resource, we, at the end of the day, are the end owner of this product, and we need to be the lead in this on what we need to be successful in our environment. For the 5000 series, as it applies, there was a program and stuff that was put in place to address the hubs, to replace them. Basically, as we've seen in other forms of our infrastructure, there was an underinvestment. The plan and stuff was there. The funding wasn't there to go ahead and execute it in a timely manner as part of our truck overhaul program.
But okay. That truck overhaul was not done.
That is correct. You know, and basically, the truck overhaul is also not just about the, you know, it's about the hub. That's when it referenced it in advance whenever we could go ahead and timely do this. But the underinvestment did not allow that.
Having determined that fixing the hubs as part of the overhaul would be the proper course of action,
yes.
It wasn't carried out for other reasons.
Yes, sir.
And when, on this slide, the reference to 10 to 12 years, was that 10 to 12 years from 2006 or 10 to 12 years from when they were first installed?
Based on what their first installation.
So that one could argue from 2006 forward, these hubs were operating on borrowed time. They were past their useful life.
Depending on when the car was put into revenue service over the several years, you know, with its challenges, yes.
I want to comment on that in terms of next steps, not what happened then, but what should happen going forward. When we have a safety issue, we now have a safety investigation and a report. We're comfortable with that. And we then have a corrective action plan. Had we had that discipline in 2006, I assume the truck overhaul would have been the corrective action plan or something comparable to it.
Yes. I mean, we looking, process changes, the resources that we have, they wouldn't have slipped.
Yes. I'm just looking forward to a point I want to make, either through a board action or, I think, more properly in the system safety plan. If we have a corrective action identified and a management decision is made, for whatever reason, to not go forward with that, that should be reported to the committee.
Yes.
And then we'll, you know, decide. If it's a resource issue, we'll decide what to do with it. But I just hate the idea that we would have cars running around with parts that we knew, and someone should have been there with their hair on fire saying, we can't do that. Wouldn't have been you, however. Tony?
Yeah. Hair on fire.
Just a clarification question. How many manufacturers make these hubs? And are we trying to get the same manufacturer for all replacement hubs?
There's only one. It is Knorr. You know, based on the liability and the sensitivity of brakes, any time that you introduce a component like this, and if you have a fault, you have some type of failure, the liability and everything else, you've really, really got to be careful when you stray away from.
Well, that's what I wanted to hear you say. So it is just one manufacturer we're using.
Yes, yes, on this car.
Mr. Bolger. Thanks, Board, for bringing up the corrective action item, which was my initial question. Is there just a couple more follow-ups on that, if you mind? So in 06, we were going to do the trucks on the 5000 series, but how much money, Dave, if you can tell us, was not made available to do this?
In 06, at that time, that's the first failures when it occurred.
Was there a budget item that never got executed?
No.
So we never had an estimate of what it was going to.
Clarification. In 2006, as I understand, is when you had a failure. It was a couple years later when the truck overhaul program was planned.
Yeah.
And the hub was supposed to be part of that truck overhaul program. Okay. The truck overhaul program, as I understand, know, did not go forward for the reasons that Dave mentioned.
Yes. Oh, so we never had a budget item in 08?
In the 08-09 timeframe, there was a project assembly. Say, for instance, we know that we've got to overhaul the truck. It's going to consist of traction motor, bearings, you know, gearboxes and everything else, and that hub was going to be part of
okay.
it. There was a project and a plan that's assembled. And, for example, we have started the 5K truck overhaul already. So we do have an itemized list of everything that's being replaced on that truck assembly.
Okay, so that kind of leads into my last question, Morty, but was earlier I asked how we are going to retrofit the 5000 series. So we have a corrective action plan to retrofit these 5000 series based on what you just said, David, with beyond trucks and propulsion, et cetera, or is that still in the works?
I would say that's still in the works. I wouldn't say like an exact corrective action plan. We have an overhaul campaign, for example, for the traction, truck assembly.
Mm-hmm.
And it consists of, you know, wheels, bearings, axles, a lot of mechanical devices mm-hmm. and heavy electrical devices. As if I could maybe broach into the overall 5K, the 5K, we've got various campaigns that are undertaken on this that we didn't have funding for. For example, like air conditioning. We started, you know, last year we had a big initiative on air conditioning going into last year's summer. Well, during this winter time, we went through and started replacing components and targeted rail cars that we knew that were heavy repeaters in a level of detail that has never seen before. We brought in the original equipment manufacturer, for example, on the air conditioning, gave them a car and said, you try to make it better.
Mm-hmm.
And then basically we stacked up our engineer work against them, and that's the type of effort that we're working. For propulsion, we're going through software modifications of that to make it, you know, more reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Another thing that's also important to point out is that it gets back to also the overall management of these rail car programs. It's one thing to start a project, but it's harder to close them out. And you have to have that life cycle and that infrastructure built in to track it. And one of the things it took us 2 years to find out is that they had never done a configuration review of the rail car. And that basically means going through, is this board at this level? You know, is this relay at this level? Is this circuit board, you know, at this level? It took us about 2 years to go through that.
From 08 to now?
No, it took, we started probably in about 08, and it worked up to about 2010 as you go through these things, because the contract was still open at that time. So it's a long process.
Just the final word, you know, back to your corrective action comment and policy, but do we have a correction action plan with all the stuff you just talked about, David, for the 5000 series? Or is it like in bits and pieces here, there, and everywhere, or is it centralized?
There is a centralized effort on what we're doing on this rail car on a per-system basis.
So the answer is yes?
Yes.
All right, this last question, why are we doing the 6000 series, and do we have a corrective action plan, or are we just doing it, the 6000?
The 6000 series, one of the things that we want to do is make sure that since the brake supplier on the 5 is the same as it's on the 6, and since we have this newer hub design, we do not want to take a chance. And I'd also like to add, as part of our 7K effort, this is with the involvement of WMATA, where we actually did the instrumentation. We established the test criteria. We saw things that were a lot greater than what people had originally specified here before. So basically, I don't want to be in a position where we just kind of fool ourselves and say, well, we're okay till 2014. No, we've already got this energy and this focus to get this addressed now, because we've got a lot of other things that we need to address on these fleets. Yes, sir.
Corrective action plan, as I was using it, is a term of art. It relates to a known safety issue, but there are lots of other plans out there that we also need to be kept apprised
yes.
in terms of campaigns yeah. on various subjects. Thank you. Other questions?
If I could I just comment on our process changes
yep.
as well? Next slide, I think it is. Process. Next slide.
That's it, I think.
Is that it? Okay. I just wanted to also just, for example, just point out a couple of things. Back in the 2006, 2007, 8 timeframe, we didn't have the Transit Infrastructure and Engineering Service Department. Basically, what is that? Basically, what that is that took the maintenance departments and the engineering departments and pushed them together. Okay? It's very important because it's one thing to start the project, but the owner has to be involved. And so that keeps training involved. It keeps the quality department and stuff involved. That's a step that we didn't have in place. Now, for example, on the 7K, you know, we've got operator involvement, our training department. So we've got the end users that are involved in this, even down to our storeroom staff on how they're going to be receiving these materials and how things are going to be categorized. Also, from an engineering perspective, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, everything was really done on an Excel sheet, or the one person had to know what was taking place. Now we've got a system where we electronically track our modifications. Basically, it's electronically available. It's always archived. We know the most recent configuration. It goes through an electronic signature process. The other thing that we have is our Maximo system, our maintenance database. Much more advanced than what they used to have here. Basically, we can stamp, we can track warranty, and then the other thing that is helping us with the upcoming capital funding is, for example, we're getting ready to go through another revision here this summer where we'll have a configuration control module in Maximo. And what this is going to do, for example, on this instance right here, we'll really know on a per-vehicle basis what level of material and stuff is can be installed on this. It's also going to help us on our storeroom side because they cannot buy a part unless it meets a certain level and criteria. It eliminates the confusion. And also, like, for example, the FTA grant that we've got on asset tracking, that'll be the other thing. It's another form of data and information that we can put together, and their tools, and these are all going to be centralized. So we've probably got 5 or 6, you know, major efforts that are underway, but I also like to say it's not only just about the vehicles. For example, what we're doing with train control, what we're doing with all these capital investments, they're all following into this process, which they have not seen before at this level of detail with this agency. So that concludes my report.
Thank you, Mr. Kubitschek. Any other questions? If not, I think the last item on our agenda is an update on the suicide intervention program, which I gather from Metro Alerts is perhaps a very timely discussion.
Good afternoon, Gary Baldwin. I'd like to provide a brief informational briefing to the committee covering three basic things related to suicide deaths and injuries. The first is just a quick overview of the statistics related to that over the last few years, the demographics, the occurrences, and related matters. A brief status of this suicide intervention program here at Metro, and then a brief look at what certain other transit properties are doing in this arena.
And Gary, if I might, just so the board is aware, at the moment, of course, we have a suicide at Foggy Bottom, so that's why there's been a lot of activity there.
Some of the background. Suicide-related death and injury investigations from 2005 to present show the following information. Those incidents carry no specific identifiable demographics, and they span gender, race, age, and socioeconomic class. 68% of the persons struck by train resulted in fatalities. Suicides have been attempted at over half of our stations. Three of those stations have had three or more suicides or attempts. Those three stations are Metro Center, Columbia Heights, and Bethesda. They occur most frequently on Saturday, followed by Sunday and Monday in terms of occurrences. Post-incident investigations have revealed that 90% of the victims had a history of depression. Just to put it in some broad perspective, in 2011, with 217 million passengers utilizing the rail system, of that total utilization, there were 6 deaths and 4 attempts, which were investigated. If you look at the following page, it is shows you the demographics, the statistics for attempts and actual deaths related to suicide. The 2012 statistic, there was an attempt last weekend, and that's not reflected here. So there were actually 3, and perhaps another one this afternoon. The incident that happened last weekend was an attempt, but it did not result in a fatality. That person is currently in an ICU unit and has a amputated foot, but is otherwise recovering. We have no other specific information on that particular attempt. On the next page, gives you a brief overview of our suicide intervention program and timelines associated with that. We had 2 vendor contracts awarded in March and June of 2011, and that involved phase 1 and phase 2 of our program. One was an assessment and program design recommendations, and then the second was providing a template for training and communications on suicide intervention. Following up on that, the initial training of train operators in suicide awareness was accomplished beginning in June of 2011, and to date we have trained almost 200. Awareness training has been incorporated into train operators' ongoing recertification training and with the station manager training, and that was accomplished in October of 2011. The next steps are that we have finalized, actually, an MOU, and that has now been transmitted and submitted to the D.C. Department of Mental Health for review and acceptance. And that MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, would be for supplemental training for staff and access and usage of D.C.'s crisis hotline. And this is similar to another program with Long Island Railroad, which has partnered with the Long Island Crisis Center for crisis intervention, and it has a dedicated hotline advertised at train stations and platforms for callers in emotional distress or are feeling suicidal. We hope to be able to implement that once the Department of Mental Health has reviewed the MOU and agrees to move forward with us on that. Once we have that in place, there will be the development of further communications and posters throughout the systems. The full implementation of the crisis hotline, and then, of course, continued training of train operators and station managers with the goal of 896 trained by January 2013. And coincidental with that, identification of additional positions to be trained.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Baldwin, I'm curious. Crisis Link is the organization that we deal with predominantly in Northern Virginia around this whole suicide prevention and hotline kind of stuff, and I'm curious about how the DC program
will work for those of us who are not DC-based and what that messaging is likely to be.
I'll have Lisa Cooper-Lucas from the head of our medical services discuss that quickly.
If I understand your question correctly, you're asking how...
Is your mic on? There you go.
If I understand your question correctly, you're asking how the crisis hotline will work?
Yeah, because our message pushing is in Northern Virginia is pushing to a different entity.
Right.
And so I'm just curious.
Well, first of all, we are going to recognize the other two jurisdictions in partnership with DC Mental Health. But the primary goal here was to be able to track our calls and to find out which jurisdiction they were coming from. So the goal here is to have the 800 number posted in all three jurisdictions and, depending upon the need, activate the people in those particular areas. In the D.C. area, the plan is to activate their crisis team, which is a mobile unit anyway, and all three jurisdictions do have mobile units. So where we don't have to create an MOU with the other two jurisdictions, we have to report that there is a crisis in XYZ area to activate the crisis team to respond. And the other piece of it would be that we would be tracking where the call is coming from, and also trying to get demographics in terms of who the person is, where they are, how they're feeling, if they've been hospitalized recently, et cetera. And it's staffed by all mental health professionals with a master's degree, licensed and above. So we expect some other intervention as well in terms of satisfying the information, but also intervening and delaying any response in terms of people feeling as if they need to jump at that point until a crisis team can get there. And then the other piece of it is that the D.C. Department of Mental Health will also, for the D.C. area, provide ongoing supportive services of mental health for people who want to see someone. And then we're creating, within my department, a referral list through the Red Cross in Northern Virginia as well as the Maryland area for referrals for clinicians who will see people in those jurisdictions as well at no cost if they can't afford it.
So if a call originates in Northern Virginia to the 1-800 number because they've seen it in the metro, that will, and whoever receives the call believes the person is at risk of doing something unfortunate, terrible, the SWAT team in D.C. will be activated and sent to Virginia?
No. Someone in the Virginia area will be contacted because each jurisdiction does have their own mobile crisis unit.
Okay.
And it's just a matter of calling them, giving them the clinical information, and asking them to respond.
But our MOU is only with the D.C. Mental Health Department.
That is correct.
You're not making those same connections in Maryland or Virginia.
No, because the mobile crisis teams, that's their job anyway. The difference with the D.C. Department of Mental Health will be that they will be the basis of the hotline. They will be answering the hotline. They've had the hotline established for years. And so where we'll get a dedicated line so that we can track where the calls are coming from and who the people are in the jurisdiction, all we have to do is access the resources in that area.
Well, I really would encourage you to talk directly to Crisis Link in Northern Virginia so that they're aware, because they do provide a tremendous number of services. The local governments do support them, and so they're quite expert in this field.
And we actually have had communications with them in the past, and so they will be included in all communications with that jurisdiction as was planned.
Great. Thank you.
Thanks, Lisa. The last piece of the presentation is just a quick, I mentioned the Long Island crisis hotline. In addition, there are some other transit properties that have various approaches and initiatives on suicide intervention. Boston has conducted a poster campaign for 1 year. San Francisco posted crisis intervention materials and partnered with two mental health organizations. New Jersey Transit, a committee was established in November 2011 to study approaches for suicide intervention and created an in-school outreach program on train safety. Toronto, which has been one of the leaders in this arena, has employee training, poster campaign, and public education, and Caltrain has safety and suicide prevention as a top priority, accomplished through fencing, barriers, and posters, enforcement and education, Caltrain has used these posters that are displayed at the bottom here, which are part of a national study funded by the Federal Railroad Administration. So that briefly is an overview of the program and some of the statistics. And any further questions?
Yes, Mr. Downs.
I would suppose, but I feel compelled to ask, there is a professional counseling capacity available on demand for the affected train operators?
Yes, within the medical department, there are several PsyDs, myself, a PhD in counseling psychology, and a couple of social workers. We're working on being notified as soon as an event occurs. However, we do reach out to the different stations when we become aware that there has been an event. We do an assessment first by phone if necessary, and then we have the person come in immediately and do a face-to-face intervention. We make sure that the workers' comp information has been filed appropriately, make sure they get into the appropriate level of care through their insurance, follow them through that process. And if it's determined that they can return to work, we walk them through that process. We also follow them over a course of time to do what we can to intervene in terms of the family issues or financial issues that present themselves as a result of this event, because this changes the entire family structure. So we also want to be available to refer people for that purpose as well.
All of my experience is the person most impacted by the suicide is the train operator who saw them just before the train struck them. And for some people, for some operators, I know that it has been life-changing.
And for some operators,
often never recovered from it. So,
for some operators, it's a career-ending event. Absolutely.
Thank you.